This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Knight Ridder, Inc., publisher of some 32 daily newspapers, including such names as the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Miami Herald, has been bought by another, smaller newspaper publisher called the McClatchy Company. While McClatchy is also considered a publisher of quality journalism, the announcement today signifies further consolidation in the news industry, a trend that, over the years, has many people worrying about the future of in-depth news coverage, the diversity of voices in the news, and the ability of news outlets to hold powerful institutions accountable. Many of those worries are confirmed by a report that is being released today about the state of the media. The annual study tracked news coverage over the past year to find out, among other things, what stories are being covered, how they're reported, and who is reporting them. And to put it bluntly, it is not a pretty sight. Print circulation is down, with big city newspapers in particular trouble. Across the media, although more reporters are covering fewer stories, original reporting is on the decline. Public attitudes to the press are also changing. Although more people regard the media favorably than in years past, they have less faith in the media's believability, objectiveness, morality, and motivations. Later in the program, President Bush prepares for the third anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq by launching another effort to shore up public opinion in support of the war. We'll hear portions of the speech he gave today in Washington. But first, trouble in the media world. How do you get your news, and has it changed in recent years? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us first to talk about the Knight Ridder deal is NPR's media correspondent, David Falkenflik. He's here in Studio 3A. Welcome, David.
Good to be here.
Why was Knight Ridder being sold?
Knight Ridder was being sold because last fall, one of its largest investors, a guy named Bruce Sherman, who sort of controls investments for a major firm, declared that their efforts to cost cuts weren't good enough. They had gone through a series of wrenching cuts in past years. They went through brutal cuts late last summer, 15% of the newsroom at the Philadelphia Inquirer, 15% at San Jose Mercury News, two of their biggest names. He said this wasn't enough to boost up profits, and it wasn't doing enough to prop up what he felt was a sagging stock price. So he said, you got to put yourselves on the auction block. He was joined then by the next two largest institutional investment groups demanding the same thing. They felt their hand was forced. If they didn't do that, they would just glut the market with their shares, sell them off, and that would drive the value of the company stock down much further.
Was the issue that they were losing money or that they just weren't making enough money to satisfy investors?
Yeah, nothing like losing money. I mean, you're talking about a company that in recent years has made between, call it, 17 and 20% profit margins in a lot of industries, in most industries. This is a terrific profit margin. But you're talking about an industry that had expected sort of accelerated growth in profits. You talked about an industry in which some of the leaders, like Gannett, makes more like the high 20s, low 30s profit margins. Knight Ridder was being compared to Gannett, which has done even deeper cuts over the last decade or so in its newsrooms. And therefore, it seemed to be falling short by market standards.
Market standards related to just that industry. I guess that's the part that I find so sort of curious, because you as you said, that in other industries that would be considered perfectly respectable profit. So it's just that every sector is judged by its own standards. Is that
That's exactly how analysts work. I mean, Wall Street's a pretty agnostic place. It's happy for you to do terrific journalism. It's more or less happy for you to do indifferent journalism. It wants you to make profits. It wants you to increase profits year to year, which then tends to have the effect of driving up your stock value.
Is there any connection between profitability and quality?
Well, there's certainly an argument to be made, and my guess is that in Tom's report, Tom Rosenstiel, the Project for Excellence in Journalism, they argue that, in fact, that strong investment in news content fuels profit. There's a connection, in particularly in community-based newspapers and geographical as opposed to national, that people do see something worth advertising in because they think readers and consumers have a connection there. You know, there are others. Gannett has newspapers that do some tremendous work, but at the same time, you know, they have cut back fairly significantly from some fairly proud papers like the Des Moines Register and the Louisville Courier Journal. And people in those cities and states would argue that there has been a retreat to some degree on the journalism provided those readers.
Under this deal, the McClatchy Company will now become the second largest newspaper publisher in the country. Can you tell us a little bit more about McClatchy and who are they and how do they think they're going to succeed with this group of properties if Knight Ridder did not?
Well, McClatchy is one of these rare companies in the journalism world where they are favorites of both Wall Street and the journalists. They have some terrific newspapers, the Sacramento Bee, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Raleigh News and Observer in North Carolina, that are known for enterprise, for hard-hitting stories, for strong work. And the way in which they've done it is that they've been very, very selective about what markets they choose to operate in. And they have done, in fact, what the Project for Excellence in Journalism suggests. They have, in fact, invested in their product, and it seems to return well. They've also made sure to invest in communities where household growth is exploding, and therefore it's a place in which advertisers are fairly hungry to reach readers.
It does seem – I think it seems to be understood that – some of these papers will be spun off. I mean, do you think that they will find other buyers, or do you think that some of these papers are just going to go away that have been acquired?
Well, McClatchy, the CEO, Gary Pruitt, I listened into the conference call he made to investors this morning, and he certainly talked explicitly about saying these 12 newspapers are going to be on the block. From McClatchy's point of view, these are the more expensive newspapers with the less profitable margins. At the same time, these are papers where there are some interest from places like Media News out of Denver. The Gannett Company had been sort of lurking around this process a little bit. And in addition, the Newspaper Guild of America has hoped to buy the 9 Knight Ridder papers at which it represents workers. And in fact, all 9 of those papers are among the dozen that McClatchy intends to sell off. You know, it's very possible that, for example, a buyer would close the Philadelphia Daily News, which is a tabloid, but that's also owned by Knight Ridder. So it's possible we'll end up with fewer newspapers than we have now.
Does it – last question, David, because I know you have to go. Does it mean something that the McClatchy Company was the only newspaper company that bid for Knight Ridder, that the other bidders were all private equity buyout firms? Is that a signal of some sort to the newspaper industry?
Well, obviously, if you'd had 7 active bidders, it would suggest that there was an appetite, that there's thought that this was not only a profitable business but a growth business. And all newspapers have been under incredible pressures, both in terms of declining circulation and declining declining advertising revenue. The Washington Post in the last few days have announced, I think, buyouts and attrition where its newsroom will be reduced by about 10%. And that's a publicly traded company that's controlled by a family very proud of its journalistic tradition. So it's not simply Wall Street making pressures. These are real financial binds. The private equity firms, you know, are looking to sort of buy it off for parts. That's kind of an issue. McClatchy was always seen as a natural fit by both investors and journalists. So to some degree, they got a reasonable price for it. It was not a bargain basement price, but it was a good price for McClatchy. Because the Knight Ridder company was so large, you know, it takes a lot to swallow that up. Even Gannett, which is the largest newspaper chain in the country, would have had to take on a lot of debt to do it. It's not clear they felt comfortable doing that.
Okay. NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Today also marks the release of the 3rd annual report on the state of the news media. Tom Rosenstiel is the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which puts out the report. He also joins us here in Studio 3A. Tom, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Before we get to the report, let's talk about the Knight Ridder deal for just a minute. Does this sale tell us anything about the larger picture of the health of the news industry? We've been very focused on newspapers, but what about the larger media picture?
Well, each media has to be looked at to some extent in isolation because they have a different economic structure and they have different problems, different advertiser problems. The fact that only one newspaper company bid on Knight Ridder does tell you that this is not perceived as a big growth business. McClatchy has taken generally a different approach to managing its newspapers than Knight Ridder has. If Gannett or Media News, the other two newspaper companies that were rumored to be interested in Knight Ridder, had bid, they were probably going to do more of what Knight Ridder had done, which is cut costs,
tighten efficiencies, which is a euphemism in the business for cutting people and cutting costs. McClatchy has gone the other way. They have grown their circulation in the McClatchy company every year for 20 years, except for 2005. It was the first year they didn't do it across the board. No other newspaper company has done that. Now, how have they done that? Yes, they've picked growth markets, but a lot of newspaper companies were in growth markets and didn't do the kind of investment that McClatchy had. So they represent a different way of managing these same newspapers, which is why I think it was a better fit for them. And they're more bullish about the newspaper business because they've had so much success in growing circulation. 20 years of circulation growth during 20 years when the newspaper business overall has been declining in circulation. What we do see that is common here across media is a pretty simple phenomenon. People don't understand really how structural it is. With the explosion in outlets offering news, the result is that most of the survivors, most of those competing, have a smaller piece of the pie. Most news organizations' audiences are shrinking over the last 15 years. The reason, and that has implications. If you have a smaller audience to sell your advertiser, you've got pressure on your revenues, and you can either keep your business growing by charging those advertisers more, by saying you have better demographics or some technical thing, or you can cut costs. And so what we've been seeing is declining circulation for most news organizations, not due to a smaller pie of people who want to consume news, but just so many more competitors in the field.
Well, hold on for a second, because this is something in your report that I just found fascinating. This report is in its third annual edition. And tell me a little bit about your group, just briefly.
We are a think tank, a research organization made up of ex-reporters and some young researchers. We're affiliated with the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. We specialize in doing content analysis, describing exactly what the press is doing. But in this report, we also aggregate economic data, audience data, public attitudes data, and create sort of one-stop shop where you can find out anything you want about the media in one place.
And you're a former journalist yourself?
Press critic at the LA Times for 10 years.
We're talking about the state of the news media. We'll take your calls when we come back from a short break. The number is 880-989-8255. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. A new report by the Project for Excellence in Journalism says what people learn about the world around them and how they learn about the world around them is changing, and this in turn is transforming journalism. Today we're talking about that report and its findings. In a few moments, we'll hear from Orville Schell, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Still with us is Tom Rosensteel, Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Tom, back to your report. One of the things that fascinated me is that it confirms something that a lot of people have been sort of feeling is true, that they think is true, but it can confirm that it is true. And you said that there are more reporters, there are more media outlets than ever before. I mean, that's obvious. But somehow there's less coverage, that actually fewer stories are being covered by more people. Why is that?
When a news organization sees its audience decline and they have to reduce the number of reporters in their newsroom, they still have to cover the big stories. And so if essentially the reporters are spread over more different places trying to sell advertising and reach consumers, you have everybody covering those big basic stories that are the must-dos, but fewer and fewer reporters who have the freedom to go off the beaten path and cover that story that may not pan out for 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks. So more of our world, if you will, is sort of in the dark. More action is occurring outside the purview. I'll give you a couple of simple numbers. The network news divisions have half as many bureaus as they had 15 years ago, 20 years ago, in the mid-80s. They have a third as many correspondents on air as they did in the 1980s. They still put out that newscast every night, but they also have those reporters covering for the morning shows as well as the evening shows, as you know, as a former network correspondent. So the menu of things that they're covering and the way they're covering them is different, even though as a consumer you say, well, instead of three networks, I've got three networks and three cable channels. That's more news. Actually, it's not more news. It's just more newscasts.
Does one medium offer a richer news diet than others?
Well, one of the things that is very clearly the case now is that as this market is fragmenting and you have segmentation, each of these news organizations is deciding what's our franchise thing, what is it that we do well. So in local TV news, for instance, we saw that half of the news whole, if you subtract traffic, weather, and sports, half of the stories are about crime and accidents. They've decided that their franchise in local television, this was true across every station studied in three different cities, that their franchise is telling people what the weather's going to be, where the traffic is, and what's going on sort of with public safety in their community. And that's pretty much it. Everything else is handled with brief tell stories. Radio news is headlines, traffic, weather, and talk. And it's a formula that's consistent across the cities that we studied. Network news in the evening is doing sort of headlines with a lot of consumer stuff. Morning news is celebrity and very emotional. It's a formula that is, you know, kind of tried and true. The only place that is attempting to do what you might consider one-stop shopping news, that could be a single source, is the morning newspaper. And they're the ones who at the moment had the worst year in 2005. It's not clear how long they can be sort of this general interest, all things to all people kind of publication.
Let's bring in our callers. Let's go to San Jose, California. Phil, are you there?
I'm here.
Phil, you're on the air.
Tom,
what's on your mind?
Question. Tom, I have a question for you. In an era of declining readership, it would seem to me that the only thing that can save local newspapers is if they bolster their local report, because they can, that way they can offer something that the internet can't possibly offer. What do you think about that notion?
Yeah, one of the reasons that we see that big city metro papers are the ones that seem to be in the biggest trouble, they suffered the worst circulation declines and the worst layoffs this year, is because they're the ones who are caught between the internet, which is largely a national and international medium still, and the hyper-local neighborhood papers that are offering that local news. And I think that Phil's right, and if this is this could be Phil Trounstein, who used to be a reporter.
Yes, it is.
And then a press spokesman for the governor. Knows a lot about the news business in California. I think the way to go for these bigger papers is to actually get more local and to maybe give up on the idea of trying to cover the national and international news and have big Washington bureaus, except where they do it in a very local way, because people in Dubuque or San Jose or La Jolla, California, can access the International Herald Tribune or the New York Times or the BBC all they want for news around the world. I think the solution is going to be more local. The problem is there's professional pride at stake there that inhibit that, and but at the moment, there isn't a lot of internet news that's very local. That's still an area of opportunity.
Phil, thanks for calling us. But what are you doing now, if you don't mind my asking? Do you miss the business?
Well, I run the Survey and Policy Research Institute at San Jose State, but I was 20 years at the Mercury News. I've known Tom for a long time. I just think that there's an opportunity here for people like the committee, Tom, to sort of lead the way in explaining to newspapers where their growth opportunity is. I think this may be the only area where a local newspaper can survive.
The problem with what Phil's suggesting is it requires investment. You got to spend money to put people on the street.
Oh, thanks, Phil, for calling in. And one of the things I'm curious about is why isn't there a market for something like the school board news or the city council news. I mean, something that would really hone in on something that has direct impact on people's lives. Because one of the things, the complaints you hear from people who are subscribers to big city papers is, I'm still not getting all the detail that I want to get about my neighborhood and so forth. Why isn't there a market for that? Is it just too expensive?
It's expensive. And you see this in the paradigm, the sort of the trap that network news, especially the network primetime magazines got themselves into. You can, I call it the sort of the paradox of 30%. If you go after those stories that everybody wants to read about, like OJ or, you know, whatever the big sort of celebrity thing is of the moment, you actually depress your audience overall because you only have those stories and it becomes a sort of formula. You can build a bigger audience by having a wider menu of things for people to read. The way it was described to me when I got into the news business is, assume that no more than 15% of your audience is going to want to read any of the stories on your front page. Your job then is to have enough variety on that front page that 100% of your audience is going to want to read one of them. Everybody's going to want to read one story there. So you can actually build your audience by covering all those little city council meetings, but it requires more people, and so you have to spend on the up front to build that audience over time.
One of one group of people who have a particular stake in this conversation are aspiring journalists, and the financial uncertainties that plaguing the news media certainly affect these reporters. What does the world look like to them? Well, joining us to talk about preparing the next wave of journalists is Orville Schell. He's the dean of the University of California Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He joins us from their studios in Berkeley, California. Welcome, Dean Schell.
Pleasure to be with you.
What are you telling prospective applicants about this new media world? Are you giving them the ugly facts before they down their parents' hard-earned tens of thousands of dollars or whatever it is?
Well, I think it's undeniable there is a sort of truth in advertising question here. You know, are we training people for an industry that is really becoming something of a dinosaur? It, in any rate, does not have sort of the full complement of jobs to offer. It used to be that newspapers, at least, had ladders of sort of mobility. You could get internships, you could move up, there were salaries, there were benefits. Magazines really didn't have that. Television at one point did, and now really has lost that sort of ladder of expectation that a young person could look out at. And really what we're contemplating is a world that is thrown into such uncertainty and disarray that there's no clear career paths for people. So, well, you might ask, and in fact, I think you are asking, what are we training people for? Just to walk them over a cliff to an industry that doesn't want them anymore?
Exactly. Well, I mean, you're training people, and I think one of the reasons that we came to you is that everybody is familiar with the high standards that you are trying to teach these students, but you're preparing them for a world in which there are fewer jobs, less original reporting. In a way, are you selling them a bill of goods?
Well, it's always and I find this very true when I talk to students, a delicate balance between completely discouraging them and being unrealistic or as I say, really not being honest about I would agree with Tom, is a somewhat alarming situation out in the media. However, I think what sustains us here training students, and I think sustains most good journalists, is the belief that journalism is an absolutely essential bridge between the world and citizens, and that without it, we'll have a brain-dead country incapable of really making intelligent decisions. So I think we look at ourselves as being in a very switchy wind. We don't really know quite where true north is in the sense of where things are going, but we do have an abiding faith that people need to know that storytelling is absolutely essential, and whether it's done in newspapers, magazines, on the internet, through interactive new media, however, that there is going to be an essential role for journalists for some time to come.
The problem is, how do you pay them? That is obviously a very pressing question. But Dean Schell, I wanted to ask you, where do your students get their news from? What are they attracted to as a medium?
Well, they're very obviously internet-centric. We do provide them with four or five big stacks of newspapers, the New York Times, the Financial Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, because I really do believe that you need to acquire the habit at an early age of steeping yourself in newspapers in order to really want them and make them part of your life throughout the rest of your life. So that's an essential kind of a training mechanism in itself, is acculturating people to wanting to sit down with the newspaper and learn about the world. Beyond that, I would say students are less interested in libraries. They're less interested in books. If they can't Google it or get it on NexusLexis, then it doesn't exist. And in that sense, they're getting a rather narrow sort of band in the whole spectrum of possible sources.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're talking with Dean Orville Schell, Dean of the Berkeley School of Journalism at the University of California, and Tom Rosensteel, Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
Michelle, if I could add one thing to what Orville said. When you meet young people who want to go into journalism, they have the same sense of calling, sense of mission that people of my generation or the previous generation seem to have, of telling stories to connect people and create a kind of community. There's an openness, however, about how you do that and whether you enlist citizens as your allies in doing that, which is very exciting. And so while we're talking about the problems, the profound problems of the economics and circulation and corporate structure and all of that, when you get down to the level of what citizens want and what the technology is opening up in ways of storytelling, that can be very exciting at the same time that we see, dark clouds all above us.
I want to bring in another caller, but briefly I wanted to ask both of you about blogs. I mean, blogs are very much discussed among journalists and also among sort of lots of opinion sectors in society. And so, Tom, I wanted to ask you first, do blogs really add value? Are they creating knowledge in the way that we believe that journalists are supposed to do, or are they mainly just reiterating or talking about other people's work?
Well, one of the things we did in this report, as you know, Michelle, is we did a day in the life of the news, and we studied how one day was covered in the national press, in the blogs, and in three cities locally, all the way down to local blogs in other languages. And what we found was that the idea that the blogs are only reacting to the mainstream press and without it wouldn't have anything to say is not true. That's an oversimplification. The blogs are bringing up all kinds of news subjects and are really adding another dimension of public discussion. But what they are not is citizen journalism. We coded all the postings that we looked at in this day, and only 5%, a very tiny number, involved any research, anybody talking to anybody, doing an interview or anything that would resemble reporting. And so what I say to people is that this is really should be called citizen media, not citizen journalism, because it adds a lot, but it cannot replace or supplant what professional skilled journalists do in trying to be, a watchdog over power.
Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Denver, Colorado. Henry, what's on your mind?
Well, one of the things that one of your previous guests had mentioned, and there's been a lot of focus on the circulation question. And I've worked at a newspaper here in Denver for 20 years, the Rocky Mountain News, and one of the things that we're seeing a lot of pressure is from the advertising side. And that really gets to the core of revenues. And there's been a lot of talk about the effect of Craigslist. And, I suppose in a subsidiary way, eBay and Amazon.com for ways in which people can buy and sell things and advertise without needing to go to a newspaper, and I suppose by extension magazines. And I was wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Well, Craigslist, for those who don't know, is essentially a citizen-based bulletin board where you can sell things do basically citizen commerce. And what's significant about it is it's classified advertising that does not then subsidize journalism. As one person put it, Craigslist is a revenue killer for the news business. And what the news business is going to have to do is find new ways of generating revenue, because classified is just shrinking. And if we don't solve that, journalism is going to shrink. I'm sorry, Arvel.
Dean Schell?
Well, I think, you know, there's one other model that we may need to consider, and that is a sort of public-private hybrid, something like The Guardian in England that has a big trust behind it. It's a commercial operation, but it doesn't have to sink or swim purely on the market.
Dean Schell, thank you so much for joining us. Orville Schell is the dean of the University of California Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He joined us from their studios in Berkeley, California. Thank you so much. Today we're talking about a new report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism about the state of the news media. Still with us is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project in Journalism. Join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. With the explosion of media, traditional print newspapers have to work harder than ever before to grow their audiences. The Washington Post is one paper that has an initiative to cultivate an audience among young readers. Joining us to talk about that is Athalia Knight. She's the director of the Washington Post's Young Journalist Development Program. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Also, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, most people don't think of high school students as the target audience for newspapers or as the training ground for young journalists. Why is the Post investing in this project?
Well, I think the Post realized some time ago that we had to really go into high schools and start working with young people at an earlier age to get them interested in newspapers, but not only interested in newspapers, but work on their reading habits. We've discovered that especially in the Washington, D.C. area, with budget cuts in schools, a lot of times the newspapers were the first things to be cut. And if a child does not understand the importance of having a newspaper in a high school, and if he's not reading that paper, he or she's not reading a paper at home, then we are in trouble. And so we basically went into a lot of high schools to try to help them start newspapers, but also try to help the kids to begin to read the Washington Post. We provide copies to the Post. We have a newspaper and education program where we provide more than daily copies of the Washington Post to more than 600 schools in the area. It's also a way of trying to increase diversity in newsrooms. We realize, especially in the Washington area, we have a very large immigrant population, a very diverse population. And in order to get some of those voices, we have to tap into those young people at an early age when they're making decisions about careers in high school, and sort of say, look, this is something you should consider. This is important. Journalism is important. Newspapers are important. And this is a good way to sort of help them get acquainted to the business.
Tom Rosenthal, one of the things that you talked about in your report was public attitudes toward the media. So first I want to stay with Athalia for a minute and tell me, what do your kids, before you start introducing them to paper, so obviously if they come to your program, it's voluntary,
right.
They must have some kind of core interest in journalism, but what media do they consume? And what attitudes do they bring with them about the news media?
Well, it's very, very interesting. It depends, because we work with suburban kids as well as inner city kids. And a lot of the students have different ideas about them. A lot of them get their news from the web. A lot of them get it from TV. A lot of them don't really read the news or are interested in the news. So you have to really sort of, for some of these students, it's a matter of sort of saying, look, let's start a newspaper in your high school. And they'll go like, well, nobody's interested in what I'm interested in. And we have to sort of, we go from there to sort of get them thinking about how important a newspaper is to the school. And hopefully they'll understand how important a newspaper is to the wider community. A lot of them, yes, go to the internet, but, you know, they read the Washington Post online. So, I mean, they're still reading Washington Post stories, but they're just online.
Do they have opinions about whether newspapers are good or whether local stations are good or bad?
I think that well, young people are interesting. There's some who are so dedicated. We have workshops on Saturdays now where we have students coming in who are really, really dedicated and interested in journalism and, you know about newspapers, and they can tell you about Woodward and Bernstein and All the President's Men, and they can tell you what's going on a daily basis. And then we have some students who like The Daily Show and think that might be,
you know, where they get their news.
Well, a lot of adults like The Daily Show,
well,
too.
Well, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with The Daily Show.
We
kind of
like The Daily Show.
Well, I'm not saying there's wrong with The Daily Show, but we want to sort of widen their places where they go to find news. I just think that that's important.
Tom Rosenstiel, tell us some of the headlines in your report about public attitudes among non-teenagers about the media.
Well, if you look back 20 years, the attitudes are, you know, all lower than they were in the early 1980s. But in the last couple of years, there's been some interesting changes. If you ask people which is more important, national security or the public's right to know, right after 9/11, about two-thirds of Americans said public security, not the right to know, and only 30% thought the right to know. Today, those numbers are reversed. Two-thirds of Americans think that they'd rather know what's going on than trust the government to protect national security. As you said at the
top... I'm sorry, Tom, did you observe a partisan difference here? Did persons of a different political perspective have different attitudes about
those? That attitude is rising among Republicans and Democrats, as support for the war has declined, too, among Republicans and Democrats both. The attitude about what's your view of the press generally... it used to be that was as low as everything else, but people now have a more general favorable impression of the press than they did 2.5 years ago, even though doubts about believability and accuracy and specific things are deepening. One other thing that's worth mentioning, the support for the idea of an independent press that is neutral and nonpartisan has remained substantial throughout all of this time. 75% of Americans still believe in that, even in the age of segmentation and Fox News and talk radio.
Tom, your report is very rich and very detailed. Can people access it online somewhere and read the report in its all its detail?
Yeah, the report is designed to exist online. It's huge. It's 178,000 words. It's two books. But the front page of it is a table of contents, and you can access it at www.journalism.org and get to basically any statistic or chart that you want to within one click.
And I'm rushing you along because we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask each of you, both of you are distinguished practitioners of this craft, I wanted to ask you, why did you go into journalism, and would you encourage your kids to follow suit? You have kids, or just hypothetical kids if you don't have.
I've got more than hypothetical kids. I went to a high school that was part of an integration experiment, and as a friend of mine at that school put it, the lessons were more on the playground than in the classroom, and discovered that there was more energy and more connection with people in the school newspaper. And in telling people stories. And I was learning more doing that than I was, you know, this is the early 70s and the classroom had to be relevant and the newspaper was more relevant than the classroom. I got that sense of calling very early.
Would you do it again?
If I were 15, I think that I would be excited by the internet and what its possibilities were. But I think the idea of a newspaper and the New York Times, which is what moved me back then, probably wouldn't be on my radar screen.
Athalia, what about you? Why did you become a journalist? Would you do it again if you knew then what you know now?
Well, I became a journalist because I really, really, really strongly, and maybe naive, but I believe I can make a difference. There are stories that I felt that were interesting to me that I was not reading in my newspaper. And I just think that that's just important. And I think there's very, very, there's a lot of power on the newspaper industry, and I just wanted to have more of a voice in that power. And that's what I encourage young people to do. And yes, I would encourage my nieces and nephews to go into journalism because I don't think it's dying. I just think that maybe there may be fewer voices, but I want to be one of those fewer voices.
Athalia Knight is director of the Washington Post's Young Journalist Development Program. She joined us here in Studio 3A, and also in Studio 3A, Tom Rosenstiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which puts out an annual report on the state of the media. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks.